Our guest now has been leading small group nature tours around New Zealand and Australia for over 30 years. Before COVID, his clients were mainly overseas tourists from the Northern Hemisphere. Today, his Nature Quest business is in hibernation. And instead, our guest, Mark Hanger, is designing and organising nature fundraising tours for non-profit conservation NGO Forest and Bird, of which he is president. Today he is leading we Kiwis into the bush over mountain ranges and marine reserves to discover prehistoric forests, bat caves and protected sea creatures. Not sure if there's some night tours to try and spot the real Kiwi. There's a full gallery on our webpage and Mark Hanger is with us from Dunedin. Good morning, welcome.
Kia ora, Catherine. And greetings from the deep south, where it's rather windy and rather warm.
Oh, it was pretty warm. Aren't you hitting 30-something tomorrow?
We hit 34 yesterday, and it's only mid-20s now, but it's pretty close.
I remember one year, and it's my hometown, so I'm allowed. I remember yes, one year it hit 36 one day and 11 the next.
Might be like that tomorrow, yeah.
Anyway, it's got a beautiful suite of beaches staying with the topic. Let's hear a little bit more about what you've been through, actually, like so many whose business has been decimated. A shock and a worry. And then what did you do?
Yeah, it was a shock. We ran a small business running nature tours both here in New Zealand and also in Western Australia and Tasmania and New Caledonia. And, of course, when COVID arrived early last year, then effectively all of our clientele, which is largely European, UK, Canadian and US, of course, that all dried up. And so effectively the business ceased to exist, at least in the short term. We haven't had many cancellations. Everyone's just postponed. So it means if things ever do get back to some sort of travel reality, who knows what that will be, then things may well pick up, but I suspect things will never be quite the same.
The hibernating of a business, so many have been through this, and practically what did it involve? Great that there were postponements. I don't know whether that means you keep any deposits. Is it more that you have the shape of a return?
We just basically put everything on hold. The sort of businesses like ours, which take people around the country, sort of fell between the cracks in many ways with the COVID responses. And, of course, all our work is largely, well, in New Zealand, it's from October through March. And so our season had literally just finished when lockdown occurred. So when it came to sort of any governmental support, that really wasn't applicable to us because through those sort of late autumn, early winter months, that's our downtime anyway when you don't normally have any income. So it meant that we sort of had to decide ourselves to just hibernate the business and just maintain sort of a skeleton office operation and work towards a time when things were more open again. So, and I guess it was through that time that we sort of realised, well, we're sitting here doing nothing. We've got three or four vehicles here doing nothing. We've got myself and one or two leaders scattered around the country that aren't doing anything. And so that's really when we sort of put all that together and thought, well, there's an opportunity here to sort of to dovetail this with the other half of my life, which is Forest and Bird.
So how did you design it and what was the plan really to say, let's use these resources and all this knowledge and put it to a purpose? How did you come at the purpose?
Well, the purpose was quite easy. because I'm president and as such chair of the board, we were addressing a number of anticipated reductions in the income for Forest and Bird. And Forest and Bird's been around for a long time. We're in our 98th year this year, and we intend to be around for a long time yet. But we were faced with very significant financial challenges last year, and they're continuing. And it was through that role on the board that I could see that income was going to be down pretty significantly, and that's probably not specifically a Forest and Bird thing. That was typical of many, many NGOs all around the country through 2020 and will probably continue for a couple of years yet. So as an organisation, we saw quite a rapid reduction in sponsorship for Forest and Bird, and that was a significant income earner. We also anticipated quite a big reduction in donations from campaigns and things going forward, because our members and our supporters were obviously going to be financially challenged in all sorts of other ways. There wasn't a huge reduction in membership, which is really pleasing. There was some there, of course, with financial constraints, but there was also a reduction in level of there was a reduction in the level of support from our membership and our supporters.
So the design of what might fill some gaps.
Yeah, exactly. And so here I had a small business which wasn't doing very much. And I guess if I go back to my early days, my initial background was in the National Park Service, and I used to run summer nature programs for the National Park Service. And leading on from that, we established a company, which is now what I have, which was to basically turn day trips into multi-day trips to take New Zealanders around and see the natural environment here. We struggled on that. The market in New Zealand was very small in the 1980s, and so we grew that and then became totally dependent on the overseas market. And so really it was to reinvent the wheel and to look at providing trips within New Zealand for New Zealanders who, of course, can't escape. in every other year, they all disappear, including many forest and bird people. They disappear to Australia or the South Pacific or further afield. But, of course, they can't do that. And they're here. They're largely retired people, and so they have time on their hands.
Was it a case of build it and they will come?
Well, in some ways, the stars were aligned. Because of my profile within Forest and Bird, of course, that helped. The fact that we had the infrastructure within my business and we could utilise that because it wasn't doing anything anyway. And then it was really an unknown as to whether, because I really didn't know whether New Zealanders, what they wanted to see in New Zealand, they couldn't see on their own. And so we put together three trips at that stage, with an emphasis on our natural heritage, on the conservation campaigns which were Forest and Bird and other groups have been running for the last 50 or 60 years to take them to those key areas, and also to have input firsthand from people active in conservation. And so it was sort of a leap into the unknown as to whether that would be attractive to our supporters or not.
So what's happened?
I put this proposal to the board and to Kevin Hague, our chief executive, and they were really supportive. And so we did it. This has happened as most things COVID and post-COVID occurred. They happened very quickly. And so we had those out to market to our members in June last year. And by August, all three trips were over full. And I sort of thought, well, maybe we can get 8 or 10 people and we can run a trip and we can financially support the society, because each trip would have a significant core amount which went to the society, and then all profits from the trips also went to the society. And so even at small numbers, the trips would be reasonably good for Forest and Bird.
So the three trips were over full, and how many were in those groups?
The Footsteps and Conservation Battlegrounds, which ran in October, had 23 people.
Wow.
And I just came back last week from two Alpine ones, and they had 21 and 18. And then tomorrow, I start the next Footsteps one, and that's got 25.
So how much has it grown from that original ambition, Mark?
Well, we've always run small group tours, and so it's going to be 8, maybe 14 people maximum. And because I didn't know what New Zealanders were willing to pay for a trip in their own country or what they wanted to see, really, because I was sort of out of touch in a way, I knew what overseas people wanted to see, but I didn't know what New Zealanders would want to see here.
Let's go on the tour. I want you to take us some of these places. But first, I am curious, those New Zealanders who have come, what have you learned? I mean, are they people who, I mean, they obviously have an interest to start with by the sounds of it, but where have they come from, and what is it that you've learned about those who've been so keen?
That was a bit of an eye-opener, actually. Because we advertised them in the Forest and Bird within the society and to our membership through the magazine, then we got a reasonable number through that. And then social media, like in 2 hours, one Sunday afternoon, I got 14 bookings when I didn't know something had gone out and something did. And so it was really, it was an eye-opener as to how many people come not through traditional ways onto these trips. And so a lot came from social media in particular. And they were both members and non-members of the society, which was great.
A lot of Aucklanders, high proportion of Aucklanders?
Yes, there were, particularly on the first trip. The first trip went in on October the 19th, since that was just post that lockdown they had there. And people were very keen to get out of Auckland. There was probably two-thirds of that first trip was from there, but the latter two trips have been much more widespread geographically.
Let's talk about what happened. I think you've just completed the first tour of 2021, an Alpine tour. Where did that group go and what did they see?
Well, the trip began in Queenstown. It was actually two sort of loops. There was an eight-day loop from Queenstown through the mountains of the southern South Island, ending up in Christchurch, and a second eight-day loop which went from Christchurch around the top of the South Island. Most people did both, but it sort of provided that flexibility that if some people didn't have time, then they could just do one half and then do the other. So the first trip was, and it was in the mountains almost every day, was into two areas in Fiordland. We purposely didn't concentrate on areas which we thought New Zealanders would have been to on their own before. And so we wanted to get people a little bit out of the way, but we also wanted to go to sort of the most spectacular places that we have. And so we weren't going to compromise just because something was a popular destination. So the trip began in there's a little road that 99.5% of people who go to Fiordland will go to Milford or they'll go to Doubtful Sound. And there's another little road which goes into the Borland Saddle between Lakes Manapouri and Lake Monowai. And so we spent a day in the mountains in there. And so it enables New Zealanders to get to an area that they probably hadn't seen before. And then it goes up the Gertrude Valley, which is on the way to Milford. And it's another little side valley with really spectacular alpine flowers and wonderful landscapes.
The wonderful themes too. The other trip, the trip that's starting tomorrow. Sorry, Mark. Keen to get to some of these places. The next trip starts tomorrow. One of them is Footsteps on Conservation Battlegrounds. Now, this is brilliant. This is going back through some of the great historical campaigns. Where does it go?
Yeah, it really does emphasise those campaigns. And like when we meet tomorrow, Sir Alan Mark, who's sort of an icon of conservation in New Zealand and one of the key people in the Manapouri campaign. That's a really nice way to start the trip. He's 89 years old now, but he's still as alert and as sharp as ever. And so he'll set the tone for the trip, and then we go across from Dunedin to Manapouri, and we go into that same area I've just talked about for the Alpine trip. And then we look at, on a sort of a campaign thing, there was quite a big push in the early 2000s to have a six-pack of national parks in the Block Mountains of the Otago and Canterbury. And so we go up on the Old Man Range near Alexandra the day after, which again is one of those areas people just don't go to. And if you get up on top of the Old Man, there's two mountains, there's the Old Man Range and there's Black Birch up near Blenheim. And if you get on top of those mountains, you just see half of New Zealand from up there. And you see it in a totally different way. You don't see any towns. There's no habitation. It's just wild mountainous landscape in every direction, and it just blows people away.
Off to the west coast, no doubt, as well on this theme.
Yeah, well, and Terry McSweeney's over there, and Terry's runs a nature lodge down in South Westland, and South Westland's doing it pretty hard at the moment. New Zealanders don't seem to be visiting there, so we go over there, and Terry very kindly talks to the group about all the conservation issues he's been involved in for many, many years now. And he's on there. excuse me. And then we move up to those sort of the big conservation campaigns that happened in the 1970s and 80s, which is around Okarito and extensions to Westland National Park there. So Okarito and Wakukupa, and then up to the beach scheme areas a little to the north before sort of going up to Well, it's slightly more recent conservation campaigns, I think, around to establish the Paparoa's National Park and in Kaharangi, northwest Nelson.
Tell me about another of these tours. Let's go north. This is the Bay of Empty tour. What does that involve?
The tour's not the Bay of Empty tour, but it's the, because of the popularity of the first three trips, we're running another one in the end of February, early March, which is similar. It's called Echoes of Gondwana, and that's got a very much an ancient sort of, the ancient character of our forests is emphasised on that. But as a pre-tour to that, we've got a marine excursion for 5 days, which begins in Whangarei and spends a day around the waters of the Poor Knights, then to Lee Reserve, and then on down to the Bay of Plenty, or Bay of Empty, as some people now call it, looking at mangroves and also looking at the whole marine issues around, particularly around Moatiti, the Arena Wreck, and that area there. And I'm extremely fortunate, really. One of my board members, Te Arangi Sayers, is from Moatiti, and he's a very inspiring young marine specialist, and he joins us for that day to take us out on the waters off the Bay of Plenty and discuss all those issues that the marine environment there is facing.
It's an incredible range, isn't it? And we head into forests as well. What of the dinosaur forest of Puriora, northwest of Taupo? Is this another?
Yeah, some of my favourite bits of New Zealand, really. The rainforests we have here, I don't think we as New Zealanders realise how special they are, because almost invariably with overseas groups, when they come here and they go through the whole spectrum of sort of the volcanic landscapes and the mud pools and the coast at Kaikoura and the mountains at Araki Mount Cook and things like that, but so many times it's that unexpected things that hits them. And the rainforest in areas like Puriora, which is northwest of sort of the central North Island lakes, it's that forest which really hits them. And it's called a dinosaur forest because it's largely unchanged from an appearance point of view. It looks pretty much like it did 100 million years ago. And dinosaurs were around in this country until about 60 million years ago. So it was around for a long time with dinosaurs in it and dinosaur relatives. And it was used in, I think, the 1990s by one of the BBC wildlife programs talking about dinosaurs. Well, I think it might have been the Walking with Dinosaurs series. And it used some of those forests like Puriora as sort of the backdrop, hence the name.
It's just quite extraordinary, the range of places that you go to. But you mentioned some of the experts. Do you also focus in on some species? The likes of the land snails. That was another West Coast campaign, wasn't it? Or the giant weta. And again, are we talking to some leading experts on these tours?
Yes, we do. We do focus on those. We focus as much around the issue and the subject as in actually looking at them themselves. And so a lot of it is about weaving the story around that particular thing, whether it's the giant weta or whether it's those carnivorous land snails. It's the stories around those, or the bats, for instance, too. And so we're fortunate in Forest and Bird, we have quite a lot of expertise in the both the staff we have and in the volunteers that work on a lot of these projects around the country. And so it's really great that they have donated their time to talk to the group. And, for instance, the day after we start here in Dunedin, on Saturday we'll be in Tautuki, which is in the Catlins, and they're sort of the project manager for one of our major pest control projects down there. Franny will be talking to the group that morning. So it's really that sort of first-hand conveyance of knowledge to groups they just find invaluable.
Mark Hanger is our guest. He's the president of Forest and Bird. He also has the Nature Quest business we were discussing earlier in hibernation as a result of COVID. And these kinds of tours he's now organising for Forest and Bird were typically populated by international tourists. Now it is New Zealanders, very much as we know, heading out to learn more about their own backyard. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. 29 past 10 it is. Mark, I'm sure there's lots of emotions going on at the moment, especially with what's happened to the business. But everyone is also saying this is a time to rethink the relationship between tourism and our environment. And what are you thinking about what should happen when those planes start getting back in the air again?
It's interesting. I can answer that probably with two hats, either with a forest and bird hat or with my business hat, but actually the two in some ways can be combined as well. And I would not like to see us go back to what we were before. One of the joys now is travelling around this country and not being overrun with numbers of people. And that's, I think, until early last year, our tourism industry was very focused on maximising the numbers of people coming to New Zealand, not focusing on the maximising the experience those people have in New Zealand, but maximising the sheer numbers that can come here. And I really hope that we can do a rejig and a rethink of that for the future. And some of that may well come because there will, I think, be a reluctance of people to travel nearly as much as they have in the past.
Give me an example of a place you're going to on these tours that is just radically different because of the absence of international tourist numbers.
I think one of the busiest areas we've always gone to is Araki Mount Cook. And you walk up the Hooker Valley there. And I remember walking up with the Sierra Club group the beginning of last year. And there was an incident happened on the track, which meant that I actually mentally counted the number of people on that walk that we saw that day. And there were 3,000 people on that track that day. And that just means it's like walking along a platform in a bus station. There's just people all the time. And this time I was there a couple of weeks ago, and there were maybe 500-600 people. And that was in peak sort of domestic tourism season. So it was very, very different. And it meant the experience for everyone was also very, very different.
What do we do, though, about the economics? Because you run a business, you also are president of an NGO, and it needs funding, and other conservation efforts need taxpayer funding. And tourism is at times our highest export earner, and other times number two. So what do we do? How do we work out the sensible way forward to the extent we can work it out? Because some of these things are demand driven. But what? How do we plan now for whatever comes once this pandemic's passed?
That's a real challenge, Catherine. It is going to be one that takes leadership from government. I think if it's left to private enterprise and to tourism operators, they are probably going to operate in a more independent manner and look more at a parochial sort of thing, whether it's a particular part of New Zealand or a particular slice of that tourism cake. So it is going to take leadership. And I guess it's one of the opportunities we have in New Zealand. Like, when you look at the world and you look at where have all the leaders gone in the last year? We're incredibly lucky we've had leadership in this country, and now the opportunity exists for this leadership to take us beyond this COVID period and to take us into what will be a new normal. And that leadership could be around the tourism there, which is completely entwined with climate. And New Zealand can be a real world leader in showing a way forward around climate, and tourism is going to have to be part of that. And so there is this opportunity for the government, I think, to involve everyone in this discussion and for them to show the same sort of leadership they've shown over the last year.
It's a big day for climate on Monday when the Climate Commission begins reporting some of the hard data between what we are promising to do and what it will take to do it. But it still feels very high level, doesn't it? And again, when you come back to those jobs and to that sheer multi-billion dollar income, what fills the gap, Mark, you know?
It is a real challenge there. And that if I probably go back sort of 30 or 40 years before tourism was nearly as significant as it is now, and for instance, the West Coast, it was timber milling, it was gold mining, it was coal mining. And now, with the West Coast, it's largely tourism. And while the tourism dollar may actually be earning far, far more there than what those other industries did, it actually involves different people And so it is a real challenge for government and for leaders as to how you can enable these changes without sort of alienating different parts of your population that may not have the skill sets for whatever you move forward with. But I think in tourism, as you move from bulk tourism to more niche tourism, then the numbers of people employed there per tourist coming in is much higher. And so even though you may drop the numbers coming in significantly, it doesn't necessarily mean that you drop the numbers of people in the tourism industry significantly.
What's been your driving force? You mentioned you worked in the National Park back in the day, National Park Service. So were you the classic young tramper who fell in love with the outdoors? What was the backstory?
Yes, I probably was. I loved sport as a kid, and so I had no interest in nature at all. And it was largely through probably a high school teacher that sparked my interest. And then I got into tramping, and then it was more probably as much good luck as good management, because there were jobs were relatively easy to come by then. And so I sort of fell into the Forest Service and then into the National Park Service. And then rather naively started a business when interest rates were 24%. It was the, I look at them now, I just laugh. It was when all those incredibly tight controls under the Muldoon government had come off and everything just went through the roof. And so I started a business, nature tourism business then. If I'd started a year earlier, I would have gone bust straight away, because, of course, you would have done your sums on totally different interest. But
thank you, Mark. All the best for it. Couple of queries. What's the age range and how fit do you have to be on some of these tours? Does it depend which ones?
The trips are designed for people of all ages and all agilities. And we use the vehicles to get to the areas of interest. So there are really neat places almost as soon as you step out of the vehicle. Or if you want to walk further, that's totally fine. The groups we've had, we've always had two leaders on them, and so we can mix and match. The age is sort of late 40s upwards.
Wonderful stuff, Mark.
But that's
thank
not
you.
Fixed either.
Yeah, true.
Okay.
Stay safe tomorrow on the Tomorrow's Trip. Mark Hanger. He is the president of Forest and Bird and also the owner of Nature Quest.